Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. It is time for another edition of Spin the Rally Pod, and is it going to be a quiet one, George? I have to say, there's only the two of us this time.
Only the two of us. Well, let's get straight into business, David. Let's just talk 100% WRC rally. No road rallies for George. No tennis analogies from Lisa, which infuriate the crap out of me, Lisa. There you go. But I do understand that they make sense.
I have to say, we had a lovely message from one of our listeners called Matty, just asking that we do get a little bit more into the rallying a little bit quicker. Matty, I'm very sorry, and it's entirely my fault. I do get terribly distracted. So yes, we will make a much better effort to focus more on the rallying. Why is it just the two of us? We've given Lisa the morning off. She is incredibly hardworking. And not to say that we're not all hardworking. Luke, our lovely deputy editor, is busy, hopefully, still out partying in Edinburgh with his girlfriend, Darcy, who finished at university yesterday. So they've been out celebrating. And he's in no fit state to join the pod. And Colin, our voice of rally, is, of course, still in Australia for Targa Tasmania. So just the two of us, George. Matty, apologies if that was a little bit too much. That was just a bit of detail, a bit of context about why it's just the two of us. Jumping straight in, George, I mentioned to you before we came on air that there was a couple of things I wanted to talk about. I didn't actually get around to telling you what they are. The first one is, we've run quite a long story this week on the Rally 3 car and what it managed to achieve in Croatia. We'll talk a little bit about Croatia before we look forward to Portugal.
Please, yes.
But the Rally 3 car, so as you're well aware, it's the four-wheel drive, 235 horsepower, junior car.
And I want to drive one, David. I mean, then, why am I not getting to drive one? Do we need to speak to Malcolm? Will he let me drive one?
We do.
Just for a test.
Absolutely. I genuinely think we should do that because it is. You know, I've written another piece a while ago. I wrote, you know, is this actually rallying's most relevant car?
It's the when I saw it in Kenya last year, I was just blown away by it. I was absolutely blown away by how brilliant it was.
Totally. And, you know, and out around the world, we've got Lucy Block using one in America. And then, of course, the junior cars were all out in Croatia. And this is the astonishing thing. So on the stage 11, where we had all of the rain, the fog, the mist and the misery, we had Sami Pajari 8th overall. In stage times, okay, the fog had lifted probably, it had improved a bit, but the road would have got far worse. You know, there'd probably been 30 or 40 cars go through those corners and pull complete mud onto the road. He has less power, but he had a softer compound. The juniors have generally a softer compound tyre, because obviously there's not as much power going through those tyres. But how, George, you're the master of the underdog and the giant killer. How did he do that? How do these cars manage that sort of performance?
Well, they're obviously just utterly, utterly fabulous to drive, and I was standing looking at it before Safari Rally last year, and I was talking to a couple of the mechanics, the Ford team, and they were enthusing about it, and they had me wanting to buy one. I mean, if I had any money at all, that would be the rally car of choice. Look, a four-wheel drive car. Nice and small, nice and light, a great little chassis, good suspension, all that traction from four-wheel drive, and enough power that a relatively inexperienced driver can wring its neck. Now, wringing a car's neck is so, so important. Getting the max out of it, squeezing every last little power out of that. And there's Sami Pajari managing that so brilliantly on that stage, just leveraged. There is a place where you can go with those little cars. Quite often it's on snowy, icy events where you can just leverage it out. It's easy to drive. To wring the maximum out of it is just as hard as a world rally car, ultimately. But it's a broader limit to get there. It's easier to get to because the speed's not just so high. It's not got that last edge of power. You know, hammering your foot down on the power coming through a muddy corner is going to make the car go sideways. But in a world rally car, you'll be straight off the road because it's so slippery. With these cars, it won't quite be just... The margins won't quite be as close. So you've got broader margins with those smaller engine cars to live on the edge. But the point being, David, Sami, he wrung that out of that car on that stage. When he steps up to the next level, if he can wring the same out of an R5 car, Rally 2 car, you know, he's going to instantly be fast. He's going to instantly be fast. And then, you know, he will, a year or so in that, wringing that neck, he'll jump into a world rally car and he won't be intimidated because the guy has been absolutely living on the very limit. Yeah. And the limit of any car, although they're different in terms of, you know, the dynamics of what they do, the principle is the same. That's what you're used to doing, extracting every last little bit of energy out of the car from the chassis, from the engine, from the transmission, from the tyres. And you translate that up and up, and it's seamless for some of these guys when they can do that.
And the speed just rises incrementally, doesn't it, with every step you take. And it all makes sense. And, you know, without making Colin McRae constantly the point of reference for everything I ever say, but you look back at his career and, you know, Jimmy did exactly the right thing, didn't he? He started him that first event in the Avenger, then he had the Sunbeam for a season, and then he was into the Nova with a 1300 engine, and then they put, a 1600 engine in it.
It was Colin, just ring its neck every time. Yeah, and Colin made that step seamlessly, basically.
Totally. Until you're on the limit in this car, you're not going to that car. But then there was, at some point, we will get round to these stories in more depth, but there was a tremendous story of, it must have been 87. So Jimmy had driven the ProDrive 6R4 in 86, and Colin obviously had looked on wistfully at what his dad was doing. Colin was competing by then. And then there was another Scottish Championship driver, might have been Donald Milne or somebody like that, had got a 6R4 for the 87 season, because of course you could still use those in national rallying. And Jimmy was doing some setup work, just doing a bit of testing with Donald somewhere in Scotland. And Colin was there, and naturally he was always there whenever there was some cars around. And Colin said to Donald, "Can I have a go?" And Donald looked at Jimmy and Jimmy said, "Well, that's your car." And Colin got in and apparently was outrageously quick. First time ever driving a 6R4. Age probably, what would he have been? 18, 19, 20, something like that. Not old.
Yeah.
And I mean, that just is a demonstration of that boy's talent, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the 6R4s leave me cold, I have to be honest.
And just horrible things to drive.
They weren't nice. I mean, and every when you saw them being driven really properly, they were brilliant. But generally speaking, nobody could wring their neck because they were difficult to drive. I think the power steering was driven off the differential so that when you came to slow corners, you had less power steering on some of the earlier ones, at least. They just pushed their way around the corner. It was a pretty awful concept in many ways, which is why it never really won very much at the top level. I mean, it was a reasonable car in some ways, but it was just missing a few elements. And for Colin to jump in and just wring its neck is remarkable. I mean, I think he had actually driven them on the road. I remember there being an issue with some cars. Was it on Acropolis Rally? Did Jimmy do Acropolis Rally in a 6R4?
I don't think he did. Colin had... Llewellyn didn't. Colin, they had their engine problem, didn't they?
Yeah. Colin apparently drove, you know, 300 or 400 kilometres off one evening with the car, just out on the road. So he at least, you know, sat in the car and understood what it did a little bit, so that when he was jumping into it, at least he would have a bit of a concept of it. Totally alien, but remarkable, yeah. I mean, that's that. But Sami Pajari, you know, Croatia, wet, slippery tarmac, unbelievably small margins. His, you know, I don't want to take anything away from him because that's a remarkable drive, and you know, thank goodness there's someone coming along to challenge Mr. Rovanpera. That's important.
No, there is. It's absolutely. It's very, very fair to say that the juniors this year is looking sensationally hot. You know, there's so many drivers coming through there with the likes of John Armstrong and Robert Verwez and people like that. It's going to be a great year. Moving on, more thing I want to talk about. We've seen this week, I don't know if we mentioned this before, but Calle Rovanpera is making his Irish motorsport debut at Mondello Park on, I think it's first weekend in May, so next weekend. When this comes out, it'll be this weekend. He's coming drifting in his Toyota Supra, a car that's run by his own team. Just talking to him, we were talking about how it kind of works, how it impacts on what he's doing in a rally car. And he said, it's all about just driving the car right on the edge of the grip level. George, what do you know about? Do you know anything about drifting? Can you remember? We did talk about this, didn't we? Because we talked about you coming through the final corner in Knock Hill.
Yeah. Drifting is it's a demonstration sport. A bit like ice skating in a way, I guess, because you score points for style, and the style is based on the degree of angle of the car round every corner. So I guess it must be about speed, but it's also about the angle. So it's an extra element. So you imagine that you're doing a special stage. And yes, there's the time, but if you've not been sideways through the corner, you lose points.
Yeah.
Or if you are sideways through the corner, you gain points. So, you know, you were fastest through that stage, but you were dead straight, so actually you're only fourth quickest.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a very quick précis of my understanding of drifting. And look, an incredible sport, great fun. It's a sport that's just been born out of love and fun, and everyone that does it just has fun. I mean, there's nothing more fun than just sticking a car sideways and drifting through a corner.
But
in rally terms, you minimise it because you're trying to go as fast as you can. But the sport of drifting has taken the speed element and put it second place to the sideways element.
Yeah,
I mean, God knows how many tires. I mean, I suppose the number of laps they do is purely limited by the amount of tire wear they've got.
Yeah, totally. I do remember now. We did talk quite expansively about this in a previous pod. So just to move on a little bit, the incredible thing though, just Kelly was. I was saying about this whole turning in thing. Do you turn it? He's turning in at like 110, 120 miles an hour. I said, how do you do that? Is it weight transfer? Is it on handbrake? And he said, and it's really, really quick. It's usually on the handbrake. So, I mean, it is just nuts to think of traveling towards sort of 200 kilometers an hour and then just getting on the handbrake to turn in. And then the even more entertaining bit, he said, you know, that's really cool. But actually the really, really cool bit is when you've got somebody right alongside you and they're a meter away, or sometimes you actually just nudge them at this kind of speed. I mean, it's not something that I've really ever watched. And then since Calle's been involved, I've watched them, and it's quite balletic, isn't it? It's
oh yeah,
incredible.
It's absolute ballet. I mean, it's just as I say, it's just born out of absolute love of putting a car sideways, it's fantastic to watch. I mean, rally cars going sideways are what pulls everyone in, the ridiculous speed. Yeah. I remember the first rally car I saw, I was on a twisty section downhill at a place called Plachettes in Kielder Forest, and it was probably 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was the first rally I'd been to, a WRC event. It was REC Rally 1976. And I'd looked at the roadmap, but the two friends I was with, they'd been to several rallies before, and we'd driven down there overnight. Felt like a long way for us to go out of Edinburgh down to Kielder. It was only a couple of hours' drive.
Clarkie's year as well.
Clarkie's year. I'd borrowed my mum's car, which was in the habit of stopping when it rained.
I was going to say was it Italian? But that would have been terrible.
No, it wasn't. It was a Vauxhall Viva with a bad distributor cap, basically, which I discovered shortly after that. But I'd looked at the road. We're on a twisty downhill section, series of corners downhill. You could see the cars for probably a couple of hundred yards. It was pitch black, and it was a windy, wet night. But once you were in the trees, the wind was gone and the rain didn't seem so bad. And there was thousands of people out there. And we selected our spot after walking about, you know, maybe a mile in or something like that, half a mile. I'm not sure how far it was. And then the car's lights appeared over the hills and then they went quiet again because, you know, in Kielder, they go along and back over the ridge many times. And the excitement rose and then fell and rose and fell as we thought a car was coming. And I could see these corners. The car would come down there and it would be a bit sideways around each of the corners. And I was really looking forward to it. And then this explosion of lights over the crest up at the top of the hill appeared. I would say blinding, but even more mesmerizing was the four glowing bright orange discs, the brake discs. This was Stig Blomqvist in the Saab. Saab 99 EMS before the turbo. And it was he just came down that road at maybe three or four times the speed I thought possible. And I was absolutely gobsmacked. I mean, you know, as much as you can see at night, the car was never straight. It was completely sideways. So that was my first introduction to cars going sideways properly at full bore. And what drifting is, it just condenses that feeling. I can imagine someone going to a drift meeting as their introduction to motorsport, and they would just be as gobsmacked as I was in 1976 when I saw Stig Blomqvist coming down that road at, you know, I mean, he must have come down that hill at 70, 80 miles an hour, and I was thinking it would be 30 or 40 and the car would be a bit sideways and quite spectacular. No, it was just life-changing moment for me. And I can imagine people going to drift meetings feeling the same, you know, some just saying, I've got to do that. I'm going to do that. I'm going to drift it. And then, you know, stepping into it somehow and starting to learn. It's not easy to learn to drift. How do you learn to drift?
No, absolutely. It is. But I think, you know, the one thing that the benefit that we have drifting is in an arena, as you know, Mondello Park. It's at a circuit.
Yeah.
Whereas our form of sideways in terms of rallying is just almost in its natural environment, isn't it? And that's the thing, you know, we don't go and stand in a circuit. We go and stand between the trees, and it is it's that sense of anticipation, and they only come by once. And it's incredible to hear, you know, your memories. They are, like you say, it is life changing. It's habit forming, isn't it? You know, it's where we learn to love our sport. I mean, it's great.
My life was without purpose until I saw Stig Blomqvist. It genuinely was. I was just wandering around after school, not quite sure what I was going to do. I'd just applied for an engineering apprenticeship with the Scottish Water Board, and I was hopeful to get that. But I ducked out of it. I ducked out of it before because I had to go and be a mechanic to build a rally car. How stupid was I? Because that was absolutely the wrong thing to do. I should have done my I think it was a 6-year apprenticeship. But you ended up with an engineering degree was the target, and my math was good enough to have managed that. Probably.
Yeah, but equally, George, look at the journey that you're on. You know, you've been sporting.
Oh, I've got no complaints. Complaints.
No,
none whatsoever. I still love my sport massively. I don't find myself going to the local events as much as I did because I don't like going to events now and not being involved. You know, if someone said to me, come along and service for us on a rally, you know, a Scottish Championship rally, I would probably go, you know.
Oh, there you go, people. Send your requests in.
Yeah, but
George
just to go along and spectate on a Scottish Championship event off my own bat.
It's difficult.
But again, if somebody asked me, I would probably go. But I mean, it was the Space Stages last weekend, and I didn't go, and I wanted to go, but I went canoeing up on the top of Glencoe instead. Sorry, Matty, I'm talking about canoeing there for a brief second. And that doesn't make me a Philistine. It just means because I like to be involved. I was doing the canoeing. If I could have been at the space side in a car, driving, yes, I would have been there. Going to these events and not being involved, having been involved in the core of these things,
it's difficult.
It's a bit like eating the chocolate with the wrapping on, you know.
Yes.
I'm not doing it. It takes the joy out of it.
You mentioned earlier that you would like to, obviously we would all like to buy a Ford Fiesta Rally 3 from M Sport.
Oh, God, yes, please. It's just brilliant.
Absolutely. But I have to say, I was very, very fortunate this week in that I did a job down at Rally Replay in Chichester. It's basically, it's run by Adam Mitchell. It's a place where they buy and they sell Group A rally cars, Group B rally cars, all sorts of stuff.
Have
this phenomenal showroom, which is kind of right in the heart of Chichester, which is obviously famous for Goodwood. Long way down there, south coast of England. But it was, honestly, I walked in, and at some point, George, we will go together. You walk in through the front door, and everything just stops. You know, you forget everything.
Wow.
We were surrounded by a proper Group A, two Deltonas, a Volta. I think it was a Volta Roll 131 Abarth.
My favorite car of all time.
A Martini Fiat service barge in the back, and rally plates going back from all back many, many years. Some of Martin Holmes. So Adam and the team at Rally Replay bought some of Martin Holmes. Late departed rally journalist, one of the most famous journalists in the world. They bought some of his cameras, so he got Martin's first camera there, and just a whole load of memorabilia. Just incredible. I could literally have spent all day. And on this huge wall, they just have videos playing. So they've got sort of a review of the 1995 championship. And honestly, it was an absolute mecca for us. And they rebuild cars. They work on cars for customers.
So like our friend VHS Rallies puts out all these incredible videos that he gets out on YouTube. This is the real world tangible version of the same. Hopefully showing his videos on the wall as well.
Exactly. So we went to the workshop area as well, and there was a whole bunch of beautiful cars in there. This is obviously not the public side of the company, and there was a Lancia Delta HF Integrale, the Deltona road car. It was an Evo 2, and they're about to start doing some work to it. It was in navy blue with a Martini stripe down the side, and it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And Adam reckons it will go for around 70,000. And
wow.
Would you buy one of those?
So that's the Delta Integrale, basically.
Yes, the last one that they made, the one with the spoiler on the roof.
The lip spoiler on it. Yeah, we had one of those at Toyota, which I drove quite frequently,
just to find out what it was like. And
well, yeah, I think we took it down to rallies just to intimidate Lancia, which was a foolish thing to think you could do. But you know, when you went around a tight series of hairpins with that car, with the doors closed, obviously, when you went around a tight hairpin, like accelerating up a hill, the door gaps opened like to about 50, 60 millimeters wide. The top of the door popped out. I mean, okay, I was leaning on the car. I was pushing it, you know, second gear up an open hairpin left and down in, I would have been up towards Nürburgring, because I had some friends that lived down there. So I would go down there of an evening, which was great because you drove down the motorway and you could go flat out. There was the motorway up to the Eiffel from Cologne. I don't know if it still is, but it used to be no speed limits. It's only about 50-kilometer bit of motorway, but it would take you about 15 minutes because you just went up there. No matter what you had, you went flat out. I remember coming down that bit of road with Petter in my Subaru Legacy. We went to Cologne for a day and had a look around Toyota when we were both at Subaru. I took him down there. We had a day to kill between a press event after the rally. And we came down there and we were doing 240 kilometers an hour with my Legacy, on the Speedo at least.
Good Lord.
Wow. It was fantastic. Anyway, so, that Delta, the doors opened right up and water pissed in. It was raining that night and water just pissed in. What a piece of shit car. Never buy one of these.
Right, okay.
But it was lovely to look at and fast like heck to drive. But
I'll keep my non-existent 70,000 in the non-existent bank account.
Unless you can wear a raincoat or you're in a country where it doesn't rain.
Or just buy it and just look at it.
Don't go around uphill hairpins with high power settings.
Certainly not in the rain.
Which is the fun of it, actually.
Yeah, well, exactly. Now, we must move on, because what we are talking about a little bit more, this is the beginnings of our lead into Portugal. Obviously, Rally Portugal is our next event, round four of the World Rally Championship, which runs from May the thingy to May the other thingy, which is... Grab the calendar, and I will tell you that Rally Portugal runs from the 19th to the 22nd of May. Very excited about that. 21 years ago, though, George, quite an impactful event, and arguably the event that lost Portugal its position on the WRC calendar, which is really strange given...
It was very unfair.
But quite ironic, given the troubles that, you know, this event had been through in 1986 when Joachim Santos had crashed and killed a number of spectators. But it still ran the following year in 87. And then actually, in 2001, it rained heavily. It didn't just rain. It rained really, 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 really heavily. And
it rained for weeks beforehand. There was a bridge washed out just the week before the rally, and it took a school bus away.
Yeah.
It was a national tragedy. I mean, it was a tragedy, but I mean, the country was in mourning. It was awful.
And we've talked about wet events. You know, I mean, it rained a fair bit in Croatia at the weekend, but that was like something else, wasn't it? That was just unbelievable conditions.
It was the conditions. It was like driving through 600 millimeter deep wet cement concrete in some stages. It was as bad as that. And of course, the World Rally cars, and in fact, Tommy's car was a Group A car still. He won the event. Led almost from the start. Well, he led from the start, but then lost the lead in stage two. And I think it took him two or three stages before he was back in the lead. But the stage times were all over the place because basically the ruts got deeper and deeper. And if ever there was no gravel clearing on that, what there was road clearing. So Tommy went off first car and basically cleared the road. He removed the road. So car number two had no road left. And Tommy was almost on his sump guard or on his sump guard. The second car was, his sump guard was basically clearing the road more and digging, you know, the last little bit of the rut out. By the time you got to car three, it was all over. It was finished, you know. It was the grittiest of drives. It really was.
It was quite a big fight though, wasn't it? All the way to the finish.
Tommy and Carlos never separated by more than a handful of seconds, given that the stage times, I mean, there was times when Tommy would lose 15, 20 seconds to Carlos in a stage, and then the next stage, 12 would come back, the following stage, 6 would come back to Tommy. It flowed around that much because the stages were just, you know, it wasn't edge of the seat, you know, driving. It was
surviving.
Literally, it was almost like tractor pulling some bits of it. You were just going through the mud and trying to keep the car. There was times when the cars were just physically stopping on the middle of the road and had to reverse and try and get up on the ruts to keep moving.
Oh, and just tell us, George, what would your job have been at that time, and how would the weather have impacted on it?
Well, just to nip back to the start of the event, that was my first year, my only year with Mitsubishi. At the start, I remember being in Portugal and going to some lovely press events with Mitsubishi. You always did. And drinking some very fine port and eating some lovely food, as you would in Portugal. Great place to go for a holiday, anyone. Great, let's go down to the rally. Someone invite me. Well, let's go. You know, I'm ready to come.
And it was based in Porto that year as well.
Porto that year. My recollections of that rally are literally every stage after stage one. I had Risto Manasimaki on the phone to me saying, George, we've got a delay. I think after 20 minutes, they had to put a zero car through, but they were trying not to. Yeah. So I was on the phone with the clerk of the course. I can't remember who it was I was speaking to. He was a lovely guy. I mean, there was never an aggressive phone call between us. I was relaying our thoughts as the team as to what could and couldn't happen.
Yeah.
The problem was there was a lot of fog on the rally as well. And I can't remember if it was on day one or day two. I think it was on day one. But it was rainy and it was foggy the whole time.
Probably throughout. Two stages were cancelled.
Stage six and seven, they were cancelled. And that was due to spectators, the rally was cancelled. It wasn't due to any other reasons, as I recall.
Right.
I was on the phone to them saying, look, Tommy was calling us at the end of the stages on the phone. He didn't do it on the radio. He was a smart cookie, you know. He said, George, I have narrowly avoided killing 5 or 6 people, and I think most of them were policemen. Wow. So the police were doing a great job of keeping the spectators back, but they were moving on the road. And because it was foggy and the sound was being suppressed, etc., etc., they weren't hearing them coming. And of course, you know, it was a lot. There was delays after the Zero car went, because it was been having to give extra time to get through the stage. So nearly every stage felt, as I recall, it was delayed. Tommy was starting these stages, and he was nearly. I mean, he got like half a dozen really big frights. I mean, it was at the point where I was saying, Tommy, you're going to have to start this stage. Look, I really don't want to, George. I said, well, Tommy, you know, just back off. You know, for Christ's sakes, don't put yourself at risk. Don't take other risks. We'll deal with it afterwards. It's, you know, we'll do what we can. Do not, you know, if you can't go near the limit, don't go near the limit. Mm. We can try and get the stage cancelled at the end. I can't remember whether we had in-car camera. We must have had in-car cameras at that point, so we can use that footage. Yes, we did have. So we can use that footage, and we did look at the footage, and Tommy wasn't lying. You know, it was the footage was clearly showing that, you know, he was swerving and avoiding policemen,
yeah,
who were doing an incredible job of keeping the spectators back, but it was too impossible. So I guess that's why the Faffy stages were cancelled, just due to the volume of spectators and the fact that there wasn't very much for them to see, but that wouldn't matter because you're out there for the event, and also the fact that it was a policeman that we were going to kill. You know, I don't know where that would have ended up, but possibly not very happy. But my recollection is lots of phone calls with the clerk of the course, and then the last day the sun came out. And the stages dried very, very quickly because Portugal, I mean, okay, it got absolutely screwed by massive rainfall that year, but Portugal's like Scotland. It's a country used to massive rainfall. It sits there on the edge of a rather warm Atlantic current. So, you know, it's a country, you know, built to cope with water. And, you know, the road infrastructure at that time was hundreds of years old and you know, well able to cope with these. I mean, it might have been small, narrow roads everywhere, but those roads were designed and built by people that understood the road had to last, you know, and not built to a cost in those days. So everything survived. Everything still worked. Okay, a bridge got knocked down by the massive flooding. And that was awful. Just absolutely awful. That was the biggest impact, really, before the rally. I remember we were all very sad about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In terms of actually servicing the cars, though, when those kind of conditions come in, it makes the job harder, doesn't it? Because before you can get to anything, you've got to scrape away inches and inches of mud, haven't you? In the same way that you do with snow in Sweden.
I remember just buckets and buckets. And, you know, you had the squeegees out on the mats and you were just... I mean, the squeegees couldn't move it. You were using shovels to get the muck out of the way. I remember helping with that, you know, getting a brush and brushing the stuff so the guys could work. You know, at that time it was, you know, it was a series of 20-minute services, and it was. I think were we doing just purely service parks, or was it still service zones? We were still mobile anyway. We were still moving to different service parks during the day. It wasn't one service park. There were service zones where you were limited in the amount of vehicles you could take in, and service areas which were bigger.
And that
so
mud,
the rally was still
was adding
mobile at that point.
A significant chunk of weight to the cars as well, wasn't it?
Oh, it would have been horrendous. The cars would have been carrying as much mud. I mean, I would imagine they were carrying an extra 150 kilos of mud without a doubt, because it was like cement, concrete, mud. I've no idea what it was like. It was just the foulest stuff, just the quantities of it. And the guys were getting down there. The guys were coming out looking like they'd been rescued from a swamp, you know, the mechanics.
Yeah,
our group A car was tough and strong, and we were the only team that didn't. You had to specify your tires before the start, and I remember when we were specifying them, I used to submit it as a team manager, and I remember speaking to Lassie Lampe and Tommy and I can't remember who looked after our tires at that point. I think it was a guy Beveridge, Ian Beveridge, and he gave me up the list. I said that can't be right, and I got on the phone to Lassie Lampe and Tommy. And I said, why are we not taking mud tires? No, Tommy doesn't want them. He just wants to cut basically, he ran one line around the middle of the tire.
Right.
Circumferentially, effectively creating two narrower tires. And it was quite a wide cut we put in the middle. That cut would have been, 20 mil across. I'm guessing, in my memory, it might have been a little bit less. It might have been a little bit more. So we so we just had the FB tire as it was, and everyone else had the mud tires. And I remember the pre-event conference. I think it was probably Martin Holmes asking us about our tires. You know, you're the only team that's not specified mud tires given the conditions. Where do you think you're going to end up? And I said, well, I just told the truth. I said, look, I was as surprised as you are when we didn't choose it. It's the driver's choice. We know the conditions. We understood the conditions. It was discussed extensively. Tommy knows these tires, and that's the tire he wanted. Michelin have given us that tire, so they must have an understanding as well. Otherwise, they would have been protesting it to us to say, "Don't do this." So we're confident,
and
that was the end of the subject. And I mean, the people were almost laughing at us, but it worked.
But
absolutely worked.
Tommy had the ability, though, didn't he? He could come up with that spark of absolute genius.
He was, and he was the master in slippery, difficult conditions. Look at his Monte wins.
Yeah.
There's a few Finns have won Monte Carlo rallies, in circumstances. I mean, Marcus Granholm, far from a tarmac expert, won a Monte Carlo rally in a circumstance, but Tommy won it four times, and that was down to his built-in. Traction control. You know, the guy is just brilliant. So he had an absolute feel for it. His throttle control was legendary. And it wasn't easy in those Group A cars because they had a disengaging rear-wheel drive. So you had to always keep some throttle. But he was, and he still will be, absolutely amazing behind the wheel. His throttle control was fantastic. And he knew what he had, and he dealt with it. And he was far from fastest on every stage. There were stages where he lost, as I said earlier, 15, 20 seconds, but then he would just pull it back. And I think he only really lost the lead on second stage and on the second last stage. Harry Rovenpera or Carlos? I think it was Carlos that took the lead on the second stage. We got it back, and then Carlos got it back on the second last stage. There's only two stages on the last day, because of stage cancellations. Well, there was only three stages scheduled. The first one was cancelled. The second one, Carlos took the lead, albeit by just, you know, half a second or something. And then on the last stage, Carlos took 9 seconds back, blew it away completely, and took the win.
A sensational event.
It was a stunning event. But what a drama! What a drama! And the Portuguese organisers, I think that. Your man Torres was away. Had he?
Cesar Torres. Yeah.
Cesar Torres. I think he might have died, but his wife Therese was still in charge. I remember speaking to her before the event, because we'd have had our team manager meeting. She would have been visiting that, or been said hello at least, and the clerk of the course beneath her. And various other signatories, and they were all a great team. I mean, Portugal's passion for motorsport is just
immense.
Amazing.
Yeah,
the topography of Portugal is all about rally, and I absolutely deplore. I'm going to deplore something now. Am I allowed to deplore here, David?
Absolutely, deplore away.
I'm going to deplore the loss of the asphalt and tarmac stages, and gravel stages that used to consist of that northern loop.
Well, these are roads around Sintra.
Of Portugal. It's Sintra, but there was other stages. As you ran north up towards Porto, you ran through, you would do a stage that would start on gravel, it would go on to cobblestones, like from the 1800s. You had tens of miles of cobblestones, lovely, lovely boulevards, not that necessarily that wide, because they weren't built at a time when roads needed to be wide, but unbelievably slippery, sealed surface, cobblestone. It's basically a stone road. And then you would be back on gravel again, and then maybe some very tarry asphalt all in one stage. And what's wrong with that? I mean, we just did Croatia. It was a rally cross. It bore no resemblance to a tarmac rally whatsoever, and so much better for it. Why have we moved away from those mixed surface rallies? Why are we so scared of them? What's wrong with going to those events? You know, the cars basically are not that different tarmac to asphalt. They're low on gravel. They're even lower on tarmac. So just put it on a mixed surface. And you know what? The engineers will rise to the challenge. The drivers will certainly rise to the challenge. And what's wrong with it? I mean, it's exciting. It's great to watch. And it's relevant. And it's real. So, and Portugal was, you know, such a beautiful event, so beautifully organized, such a fabulous country to go and visit. The cakes, the food, the seafood, the dairy products, I mean, the coffees, it's just, it's a great place. And they've got that incredible topography that just lends itself to rally. And you know what? In Portugal, the local councils, everybody's still enthusiastic to have the rally. The memory's there for it. You would get the permission to run it, but we constrain ourselves in such a way. It's beyond belief, you know, and you know, in much in the same way we have a single service park, which limits what the event can do. Why do we have a single service park? Tell me the reason for that.
Well, it contains everything in one particular place. It makes it easier for the teams. There's less logistical costs for the teams. It's easier to bring partners and guests into the event.
I have never heard you less convincing than I hear you right now. I know you're unconvinced by that argument. Those are the arguments, folks, that are given to us. I can tell you that the guests that we used to bring to rallies, we'd put them in a coach and they would be taken out to stages. We'd have, you know, we'd have a little encampment on a stage that wasn't too far for them to walk through the woods. We had everything organised, and those people got the full spectator experience, much better than walking into some sort of temporary camp, which is all very splendid. Yeah. The service park is wonderful. It has its attractions. But honestly speaking, getting out there into the action is what it's all about.
Absolutely.
That central point, the drivers are driving. They've not got time to indulge in guest visitors and things at any point. So it's a pointless affair. Get back out on the road, I say.
Obviously, I agree 100% with what you say about the lack of tarmac and stuff in Portugal. The one stretch that obviously we still do have, it's a very, 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 very short stretch, is the on the Fafe stage where they come down the hill, square left onto the small road with a big saltire painted on the road, and then hairpin, the very famous hairpin, right back up onto the gravel. These are iconic locations, aren't they? And Portugal is just full of them. It's somewhere that you never, ever tire of going. Every year, it's an adventure. And for me, it was an absolute crime that the thing was kicked out of the championship for 6 years between 2001 and 2007. And then potentially in an even bigger crime that they took it down south to the Algarve. You know, that's not rallying territory at all, is it?
It's not, but my goodness me, it gave us a great event as well. I felt the same when it moved. I was so disappointed, and then of course I went to it, and it was fantastic. It's still Portugal. It's a slightly different part of Portugal. It's a bit warmer.
It's true.
They don't quite have the swings of weather because they don't have the mountains behind them to squeeze the moisture out of the air and give us the rainfall.
But those swings of weather is what Rally Portugal's about. It's like having a bone dry Rally GP, isn't it?
Or it kind of is, yeah. I mean, you do get them, but they're rare. So, that history of Portugal, it's another event. You know, Portugal Rally GB, you know, RAC Rally as we know it. But again, it was denuded over the last 20 years. It's been denuded something terribly. The last couple of years when it went back to North Wales made it somehow better, which is a shame because actually South Wales and Mid Wales is brilliant. I don't want to take anything away from the massive investment they made, but honestly speaking, we should be starting the rally on a Sunday, running around the stately homes. That was amazing, and then do two or three days in the forest.
Have you done a Roger Albert Clark? This is historic event.
Desperate to do it. If I could do that in a Fiesta R3, my life would be complete. You're probably not allowed to do it in a Fiesta R3.
No, you are. There's a modern section to the event.
Is there?
Now, but I think because obviously it ran last year, so I'm pretty sure it doesn't run. It's a biannual event. So I don't think it will run this year.
Well, it ran through that storm we had, didn't it?
Yes.
That windy night, a wee bit breezy.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
They ran it through, all strength to them, like a proper rally stuff.
Well, I'm just
keep going.
Frantically looking, and if we do have any listeners out there who are part of the Roger Albert Clark Rally, get in touch and let us know. I'm sure that your event is running next year, not this year. If it's next year, if we are around, I think we commit to doing it, George. I think we commit to
Is that Rally Blind, or is it Pace Notes handed out?
I think it's Route Notes, isn't it? I'm sure
route notes. Okay, hey, look, I was just going to say for a co-driver, if it was blind, you just get down on the map or you just sit there and watch. which is great fun as well. You know, I'm still happy to drive blind in a forest.
Colin and I have talked for years about being desperate to get out there and go and work on that event. So, and of course, Luke, our deputy editor, was there last year. So I think we commit to doing it. We talk expansively about how great the Britain's Round of the World Rally Championship was back in the day. And there's one event that captures that every other year. So let's get out there and have some of that next year.
And that leads us back to Portugal, how fantastic it is. Look, they're back in the north. They're using many of the stages they used to. Yeah. I say many, they're probably using about 20% of the stages they used to, because the rally used to run the length of the country from Lisbon up to the north and back down again. And it used to do that, you know, I mean, it was, what an event it was. The first Portugal rally I did just seemed to go on forever, even though we stopped early, all our cars retired.
But we do have the places like Arganil. We've got Arganil in there. We've got Lousada, which is a great spectator stage.
Up at Castela de Piana, right in the north, over the river.
Amarante, and of course, Fafeas, a power stage on the Sunday, which of course
tremendous.
It always is, yeah. So
I have rarely looked forward to a rally more than Portugal this year. I'm really looking forward to following it and getting into it and talking about it afterwards and listening to all the video casts that you're giving us.
Yep.
Following it on WRC, hopefully the weather won't be too awful, because the weather does seem to affect the footage we get back.
And I'm hoping that
we can see some more of that fabulous drone work that we saw in Sweden.
Yes.
I want more and more of that, guys. I don't suppose they listen to our podcast, but I thought that drone footage they did was really something amazing. That was something new and something stunningly good.
Yeah. No, I agree.
It felt like you were in the car. It was the best spectating I've done since 1976, when I watched Stig Blomqvist come down that hill. That's how good that drone footage was.
We've been doing the drone in ARA for a while now, so it's nothing new in America, but it does give you a totally different perspective. It's enormously spectacular. George, I think our time is up. We need to sign off. Thank you very, very much for your company. It's a great way to start.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm hoping that Matty has enjoyed our more concise, purely focused on WRC discussions, with its odd little tentacle off into the history of our sport, recent history of our sport, where it's very relevant.
Yep. Luke, and Darcy, I hope the hangovers aren't too bad.
They will be awful.
And we will be back, hopefully, as the full crowd. I'm not sure we'll have Colin with us next week. We can hope. It would be lovely to welcome Cole back to tell us all about his adventures in Australia. And in between now and then, whatever you do, stay tuned to dirtfish.com. And George and I will see you and talk to you next week.
Fantastic. David, thank you. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll catch up soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, George.